there's the bell, and here we are. Welcome to STR Ask, STR's newest podcast, probably the shortest STR podcast. Mm-hmm. We are known for being a little bit long-winded sometimes.
Hi, Melinda.
Hi, this is Melinda the Enforcer, and I'm here with Greg Kokel.
And last week it was Brett Kunkel.
Yes, I was sick. Your son. That's what people think. Brett Kunkel's Greg Kokel's son.
I still don't understand how people could think, you both start with K, so you
There's
must be
K's
really...
There's K's and L's, and all the rest is just a mishmash.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you go. So, the name of the show is hashtag STRAsk, because that's how you submit your questions for this program. You go to Twitter, and you use hashtag STRAsk, and we're able to find your questions there. The program is short, and the answers are short. Greg is on the clock. He's got 4 minutes, up to 4 minutes to answer the questions, and you never know. He might do it in less than 4 minutes. It is theoretically possible. It's not logically impossible. Just never been known. So let's get going. Ready?
Okay. Yeah.
First question comes from Brian Woodward on Twitter. What's your take on John 14:12? Why don't we see Christians raising the dead, multitudes of healings? Was this literally? And let me quote John 14:12. It says, "Very truly I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these, because I am."
Well, let me take a look at that. Just so, John 14:12.
And let me point something out. I just read a Bible verse, and the question is asking about a Bible verse. So the first thing Greg did was open his Bible to actually read the whole context.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm basically, this is Upper Room Discourse, and it's the last night of Jesus' life, and he's giving lots of instructions to the disciples. And part of what he's saying here is that, okay, I'm going away, which surprised them, but I have to go away so I can send another, because the other is going to work in you and accomplish things greater than I could do by myself. Now, I guess you could read verse 11 as, is that a verse 11? Yeah.
12.
Or 12. He who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these. And greater, actually, the word works isn't in there. It just says greater than these he will do, because I go to the Father. Now, of course, the because I go to the Father is making reference to the Holy Spirit. Because when he goes, he will send the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth. I will give you another helper, verse 16, and he will be with you forever, and he is going to work. Now, what's interesting in verse 17, it says, that is the Spirit of Truth, whom the world cannot receive because it does not see him or know him, but you know him and abides with you. And I don't know if this is the place where he says it or not, but he makes reference to the Holy Spirit bearing witness to him. Well, I guess you could take verse 12 to mean that all the things that Jesus has done in terms of his miracles will be done by other Christians in the future, and even more so. And frankly, I don't know why that hasn't been fulfilled. Jesus raised a number of people from the dead, but there have been lots of resurrections from the dead that are on record, if you believe the works like Keener, what's his first name? Craig Keener, yeah. Craig Keener and his 2-volume work on miracles, where he chronicles these things. So there's no reason at all to believe that that wasn't fulfilled just in that way, that the multitude of Christians that are filled with the Spirit and work and operate in power as a result of the Spirit in their lives has in aggregate greater works added all together than what Jesus performed by himself when he was in his earthly ministry. So I think, from what I could tell, there has been a straightforward fulfillment of that. But it's not entirely clear to me and to others that Jesus really was referring to just doing more signs and wonders to wow people, but he could have been referring to the broader impact of the gospel message going forth with power through the multitude now filled with the Spirit communicating the message of Christ and his work on the cross. And so this could be referring more to a spiritual impact than just merely signs and wonders themselves. But it seems in either case, this passage has been fulfilled. because somebody doesn't see somebody raising a bunch of dead people right now doesn't mean there aren't dead being raised or haven't been raised in other parts of the world. If that, in fact, is what Jesus is referring to, then those things have indeed taken place. That seems to be the testimony.
Yeah, just pick up on the last point you made. Part of the answer seems to be in, Brian asks, why don't we see Christians doing these things? Part of it is, well, where are we looking? Because a lot of these things are being done in third world countries, mm-hmm. where the gospel is still being proclaimed, and these are testifying works.
Yeah, exactly. And there's also another factor here that just, and I became a lot more aware of this after I lived in Southeast Asia, in Thailand for 7 months. People in those countries are raised with a different sensibility about the world. The idea that spiritual forces are at play is not just kind of an academic thing for them. That is, they don't know. Well, we acknowledge that that is true. This is a visceral reality to them because they grew up in cultures that were ruled by animistic spirits in many cases. And so they understand and believe in the spiritual realm, and they believe in supernatural power. And so they are better, in a sense, dispositionally equipped to trust God to work in these ways than we are. I mean, I have a very hard time conjuring faith for healings because I've not seen healings. And
although you were healed once.
Once I was. And I never, I haven't had any prayers of mine for other people's healing answered as far as I know. So it's hard for me to conjure up the faith. But people who are raised in an environment where this is, they traffic in this more often. It is. It just seems more natural. It's easier for them to believe, and I think God responds more to that faith. So that may be another factor, too.
Okay. Second question comes from Henry the Tech on Twitter. He says, his in-law is an elder in a gay church. I've attempted to exhort and failed. He says, I'm stuck between, I think it's 1 Corinthians 5:11 and the fifth commandment, which is about honoring your father and mother. He says, what do I do now?
I'm not sure how honoring his father and mother come into this. Is this, he said, a relative?
It's his father-in-law or mother-in-law. I guess part of his dilemma is not associating with those who continue, you know, who believers who continue in sin, and yet needing, you know, this is an in-law, so assuming you. We need to honor them,
yeah,
too.
And this is the passage in 1 Corinthians 5:11. I told you not to associate with any so-called brother if he's an immoral person, a covetous or an idolater, a viler, drunkard, swindler, etc., not to even eat with such a one. This is kind of a moral dilemma because on the one hand, this being a relative, there's a point of honor that's appropriate here. But at the other hand, if this person claims to be a Christian but is living an immoral life, well, then this immoral Christian ought to be ejected from the fellowship. That's Paul's point here in 1 Corinthians 5. There's a person who's living in immorality. I think it's a little harder when you have a person who holds to a wrong view, a wrong moral viewpoint. It doesn't sound like this relative is a practicing homosexual or not. Or is it just somebody who is sympathetic to homosexuality?
An elder in a gay church, so.
Oh, well, I guess that.
I mean, if he's not, he or she isn't gay, yeah, he's at least.
Yeah, well, look at, if I were.
Heavily promoting the view.
Right. Oh, this is. Well, I'm caught between a rock and a hard place. I mean, that's the.
Well, that was the question.
Yes, that's the nature of the question, right. And so. What Paul is addressing in 1 Corinthians 5 is a circumstance in a local church where immorality is allowed to reign such that it leavens the whole loaf, so to speak. The sin permeates and others are negatively influenced by it. That isn't the circumstance he's facing here. The circumstance he's facing there is a church that is fully leavened. It's a gay church, for goodness sake. There is no spiritual life there at all. They're not a so-called brother. They're not brothers at all there. I would treat them as non-Christians personally, and leave it at that. It's not a situation where you're going to try to expel somebody from the group because they are corrupting the local church. they're a corrupting influence. The whole local church in this particular case is corrupted. So I guess I would lean towards maintaining some fellowship with the person with the understanding that this person's not a Christian of any kind. And I wouldn't even call them a so-called brother. They're just, you know. So as best I could do on it, I think it's a tough call because of this. It's a family member, but that would be my my response there.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Next question comes from Barry Wallace. What do you think of Lewis's view that we should consider Christian marriage and secular marriage separate things?
Well, it depends what he means by separate. I mean,
in our culture now, a Christian marriage and a secular marriage are the same. If you're married in a church, you're married in the secular world. So I guess his suggestion is, what if we treated marriages in churches were marriages in that context, and they're not necessarily considered secular marriages, and secular marriages are a different thing.
Well, but there is that distinction, and this is why I'm balking here. I'm just, on the one hand, I agree that there is a distinction. A person could get married in with a justice of the peace, and there's not be any religious trappings at all about it, okay? Now, having said that, they are participating in something that is built into the human condition, and it is built into the condition by God himself. So a person can only have a secular marriage in the sense I just described because God himself has established reality the way it is to make marriage possible or meaningful or, at all between human beings. So even though they have a secular perspective and a secular intent, and there is no religious trappings to the marriage, it is still embedded in the way God made the world, okay?
Marriage is a natural institution.
It's a natural institution, right. So I'm willing to acknowledge the distinction in this sense that there can be marriages where you have religious elements to the celebration and marriages where people don't practice the religious elements.
You're really saying weddings.
Weddings, yeah, that's a good distinction here. But I don't want to say is that you have two species
of marriage.
Of marriage.
Yeah.
One marriage that is a religious thing and you could put religious restrictions on it. And the other kind is a whatever marriage. So you could have same-sex unions, and I don't know why you can't have polygamy or polyandry or polyamory or you know, why can't marry animals for that matter if it's just a complete secularized thing.
Or marry yourself.
Marry yourself. So, I couldn't do that because I'd have to live with myself the rest of my life then, you know.
You don't want to do
till death do us part. Do me part. That doesn't even make any sense. But so I think there is only one institution of marriage and it's tied to the way reality is structured. It's a natural institution and we can account for the existence of that natural institution because of God's role in the creation of those things and creating a man the way he is. Governments have just mapped over that natural institution up until just recently, okay, by giving licenses, and therefore they strengthen the institution because they recognize the value of it. I am just reluctant in making this move in a cavalier fashion because I don't want it to. I acknowledge there's a difference between secular weddings, maybe is the better way to put it, Melinda, like you did, and religious weddings. But I don't want to act like there's two separate kinds of institutions because then it really, what it does is this is a tacit way of admitting that it's just a convention anyway. And you could have a religious convention and you could have a secular convention because we're just making it up anyway. And that's where I don't want to go.
That's a very good point.
Of course it is.
Which is why you made it. Let's take a little bit of a moment here. I thought we'd promote our cruise next summer.
Oh, yeah.
You want to tell people about it?
Well, this is our third?
To Alaska.
To Alaska. We've had, this will be our fifth cruise, but we've had two others to Alaska, which were wildly.
I think it's our sixth cruise, but the third to Alaska.
Okay, third
to Alaska. You're right on that one.
Okay.
Caribbean and Canada.
Okay. 2 + 2 = 4.
Oh,
plus
you're right.
One,
sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Regardless, people were wildly happy with their Alaska cruises. It is the quintessential cruise choice. If you're going to have one cruise, go to Alaska. And we go in August. The weather has always, for us, been really good. It's the Inside Passage, right? It's the mm-hmm. We leave out of Seattle. You can mention the ports. I think we go to
Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan, and Victoria, British Columbia.
Classic ports.
Sitka has a beautiful sound. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little Russian town. Gorgeous sound, you know, that's very different from the others.
Right.
Ketchikan has Ketchikandy. And Victoria, British Columbia, we spend the evening there, and it's a very British city,
right.
And you can go downtown and see the Empress Hotel or take mm-hmm. a quick trip out to Bouchard Gardens. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's fabulous. So on that order, I want to say once-in-a-lifetime trip, but people take it more than once because it's that good.
My parents went 3 times.
Yeah, so on that, but it's better than that because it's a conference cruise, which mm-hmm. means that while we're cruising, which in a good part of the time we are between ports, we are spending time together in different ways. We're having a conference. That means there are speakers that are giving presentations, and our speakers this year, in addition to myself, for Stand to Reason, are J. Warner Wallace, Cold Case Christianity, and formerly of STR, and also John Stone Street. And John, many of you know, formerly from Summit, and I guess he's still involved there, but he's most well-known now because he's working with Breakpoint and Chuck Colson.
Colson Institute.
And these are fabulous communicators. They have great things to offer to thoughtful Christians. And not only will they be speaking, but they'll be with us. We'll be cruising together. So families
be able to share
together.
Meals with them,
exactly.
Breakfast, talk to them casually. And one thing I realize some people don't understand, none of the conference sessions conflict with being in ports.
Right.
We only have sessions when we're out to sea.
Correct.
And not the day that we're viewing Glacier Bay.
Yeah, and I don't want people to miss the impact of the comment you just made. When we're together, we're together. I mean, these aren't speakers who just, you know, hit and run kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There they are. They're gone now. You know, oh, we got a signature and a book. Another. No, we're all together for this mm-hmm. week. And that means not only meals times, but a dinner, but special breakfasts mm-hmm. where you can sign up to have breakfast with one of the speakers. And so there'll be 4 or 5 around a table and enjoy the speakers in a one-on-one that way. There's conversations that happen, of course. And all of us are very generous with our time. John Stone Street, J. Warner Wallace, myself. And we look forward to interacting with people. So we just want to encourage you to mark the date. And the date is
August 6th through 13th.
There you go, August 6th through 13th.
And you contact Inspiration Cruises, and their number is 800-247-1899, or go to inspirationcruises.com/STR for information.
We sure hope you can join us.
Yeah, it's going to be a great trip. Okay, back to the questions, and back to 4 minutes. Jeremiah Lyons asks, "Hi, Greg. I recall you mentioning on a past show that prior to God creating the universe, God had the ability to count to 10. If God did not create and enter time at the moment of creation, how do you reconcile God's temporal thoughts sans creation while avoiding an infinite regress of past time?"
Well, this is a complex question here, and I've not been asked it before, so I have to think about it. He's presuming, what I stated was, it seemed to me that sans creation, without creation, before creation, God could have easily been temporal. Now, William Lane Craig does not think that God was temporal. Gary DeWeese thinks that he was before creation.
I think he was.
Bill Craig thinks he was temporal. He entered time at creation, okay? So these are all views of divine temporality. So we are all in this discussion acknowledging that God is temporal, but how long has he been temporal? Did he enter time, so to speak, at creation, or was he participating in temporal events prior to creation? And I had just raised the point, it seems to me that God could, prior to creation, could have counted in his mind from 1 to 10. And if he were to do that, then this would identify moments of time distinguished by the different numerals, because when he gets to 2, number 1 would be passed even to God. And so this was a kind of a point that God could be temporal. Now, what is before creation? Now, the rejoinder, though, is, or the pushback is, well, this creates a problem for an actual infinite of what? And this is where, can you read that section again, Melinda? Because I'm not sure
how do you reconcile God's temporal thoughts sans creation while avoiding an infinite regress of past time?
Well, this is what I don't understand. How would there would be an, I guess it'd only be an infinite regress of past time in that God is infinite and he is temporal, so that would be an infinite, well, that would be an infinite temporal moments in the past. Now, the only problem I can think of, that's not an infinite regress. Mm-hmm. Infinite regress is where you know, one thing requires another thing before that and another thing before that, and you can never get the thing going because of the infinite regress.
And a universe needs to get going.
God
so didn't need to get going.
Right. So there are difficulties with infinite regresses. I don't think this is actually an infinite regress, but to be charitable, I think there is a concern that he might raise, because you could argue, well, now you're going to have an actual infinite of past moments. And this is something that Bill Craig argues against. I personally don't argue against actual infinities. And one reason is I have a suspicion, and somebody else pointed this out, is a lot of the conundrums of actual infinities are only conundrums if you treat infinity like a number rather than a concept. And so, you know, the Horton's Hotel and things like that, these conundrums that Bill brings up, I guess I'm not so comfortable with those. I don't think we need to make that kind of point in order for our Kalam argument to go forward. We could simply say we don't have to argue there cannot be any actual infinites. Maybe there can be, but it doesn't salvage our argument for the Kalam. As long as we say there can not be any actual infinites that are accomplished by successive addition. Mm-hmm. And that would be all that's required to prove the impossibility of the universe being actually infinite, because it would have to accomplish that actual infinity by successive addition. Now, maybe that's the problem, and I'm still kind of working through this question because it's just now occurred. Maybe that's the problem that is being posed here, that this means that there would be an actual infinite of past events in the mind of God. And I'm just going to have to chew on that one for more, because I'm not sure if that's the point that he's making, or how I'd answer if that were the case.
In your example, when you do this, and I remember we've talked about this in the past, God could have existed atemporally from eternity, and prior to him saying, you know, bringing things into existence, he could have then entered time by having a succession of thoughts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's what you're talking here. But part of the thing is there's a difference between physical time and general time, or metaphysical time.
Metaphysical time, right.
Right. And the
God's clock, so to speak.
Right. I mean, the universe, physical time is clocks and things like that.
Right.
That's a different thing than there being time apart from a physical universe.
Right.
And so God didn't always have to exist in some kind of temporal state. He could have existed atemporally and at some point prior to the universe
beginning.
Perhaps when he and, you know.
Well, that's Bill's view, right. Although he says that he enters time at the point of
time, right.
Yeah, when he starts acting.
Right, but it could have been even sometime prior to that.
Yeah, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't
time.
Be.
And then you don't have this infinite regress.
Well, yeah, even if God, yeah, right. Yeah,
okay.
I don't know why there would have to be an infinite number of temporal events. If God was temporal before creation or sans creation, why that would lead to an actual infinity of temporal events. I guess that's the step I don't see that follows, and so therefore I don't face that problem. Maybe that's the simplest way of putting it.
Okay, since we've stretched our brain on that one, let me ask you, finish up the program with one quick one, and let's see if you can actually do this in 2 minutes. I think
All right.
You probably can. Courtship or dating? This comes from Spencer Johnson. Courtship or dating?
Oh, you know what?
And since you have two daughters, I'd like to.
Yeah, but they're 10 and 7, so I haven't really been thinking about that lately.
Well, you better
lately.
Pretty soon. Silence isn't good for an audio format.
No, I understand that, but the nature of these questions are things that I haven't, many a times, I haven't really worked through for myself, and or they're somewhat esoteric and whatever. Dating is just hanging out with lots of different people and going with lots of people and testing folks out. You know, okay, that's the idea of dating, as opposed to courtship, where you don't try to connect personally with an individual unless your goal is to pursue marriage with that person. And that would be maybe an older style of people. No, people didn't hang out and date like they do now. And there are all kinds of problems with that, I realize. But that's my standard, what I was raised with, you know. So I don't know what courtship, how that really looks. I like the idea of courtship because it is old-fashioned and it seems to be supportive of certain values that I have about marriage. At the same time, I'm not sure how practical it is for everyone for as a rule, you know. By the same token, I don't, you know, if you dating, then this creates other liabilities. So I'm just going to have to work on that one, and I'm going to have to get with it pretty quickly, or else, because my daughter's within the next 6 years. I mean, she's 10 now; she's almost 11. Mm-hmm. So.
She's not a little girl anymore.
I don't want to think about this stuff.
Yeah. Maybe
I'll be dead by then.
Maybe it's, you know, not dating or courtship, but I think the idea, the attractive thing about courtship is it's getting you to think, to be looking at the people you're going out with for the qualities that are going to make for a marriage and a partnership, and not just to casually, you know, date not just go to have fun. So maybe there's a way of, you know, to encourage your daughters to date, but to take these things seriously, because kids always say when they're dating somebody you don't want them to date, well, it's not serious right now. Yeah, well, when it does get serious, you're not going to want to think about these things
then.
So that is the advantage.
So maybe there's
a
hybrid
mentality.
There might be a hybrid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you, Belinda.
You're welcome. So this is STR Ask. The show's posted every Monday. And you can post your questions on Twitter using hashtag STRAsk. I'm Melinda the Enforcer and Greg Kokel for STR. See you next time.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous